Today, I'm in conversation with Peter Vowles, the British ambassador to Zimbabwe. You're watching the UK series. I go beyond the headlines and beyond the sensational. If you enjoy this conversation, remember to subscribe, to like, and to share. Let's get down to some work. Greetings. Welcome to In Conversation with Trevor UK series, brought to you by the Nyarazo Group. I go beyond the headlines and beyond the sensational. If you enjoy this series, remember to subscribe, to like, and to share. Let's get down to some work. Peter Vowles, welcome to In Conversation with Trevor.
Thank you. It's a huge privilege and honor to be in conversation with you.
We've been wanting to do this for a while, haven't you? And then you lost your voice and then, you know, but finally we get to do it.
We're finally here, yes, perfect. Looking forward to it.
Wonderful. Looking at your life and reading around the things that you've been able to do, something strikes me as unique and interesting. You love this country, hey?
I absolutely love this country, yes. My sort of formative years were spent here in Zimbabwe. The first job of my career, back in the day when Zimbabwe hired young expat teachers and put them in rural areas. So I was employed by the Ministry of Education to be a teacher in Mudzi, where I spent a year. And I mean, it was a transformational year for me. I learned so much about the world, about myself. I saw the world from a different perspective. And then I went on from there to live in Marewa, where I rented an office from the district council and lived in the Growth Point, and then traveled around Mashonaland East for a couple of years. Again, just learned so much. And then I left. I had a couple more years here in Harare and in Bulawayo.
Before you leave, you say it was transformational. I mean, unpack that for me. That's a big term. What does it mean? What happened to you in terms of your relationship with the world and your developing as a person? What did that mean?
Well, I was a young British man who'd, you know, lived a reasonably kind of normal life in Britain, probably from a sort of middle class family. My family had travelled a bit as when we were younger, but I lived in the east, at Ipswich, in fact, in the east of the country for my schooling. And then here I was in Zimbabwe, living in the middle of rural Zimbabwe, and it was a complete, obviously, culture shock, but complete change, a completely different perspective on the world, which has stayed with me ever since. Seeing the world, seeing different perspectives, living in, you know, our life was in a teacher's housing in Mudzi, down to the local Growth Point at Suswe, coming into Marewa, coming to Harare occasionally, and just lived a life that was just so different. And I think for young people, having that just complete change of perspective was just, I mean, it's fascinating. I learned a huge amount, and people, I hope I managed to teach a bit while I was here too, but I just learned so much about what matters in the world, because I was living in a community that was living with very little at the time, and it just it gave me the set of perspectives that I would never have had in
any. I can't help asking, so what matters in the world? I mean, you're down there in Guruve, you're down in Mudzi. What then at the end of the day says to you what actually matters?
I think humankind, people, the relationships you form are so kind of central to everything. And I guess it's probably fair to say that Britain in the 1990s was becoming more and more kind of consumerist, as even more so today, where so much is about what you own and what you possess. And I think probably spending that time in Mudzi, that it's not all about owning things and possessing things, but just about the relationships that people had and the family, the importance of family. I think, you know, the importance of belief and kind of cultural connections, all of those things that I think I've kept with me ever since. And I've been fortunate enough to have a career that's taken me all over the world since, but I always come back to those experiences of what it felt like living in a community in rural Zimbabwe, and that's just stayed
amazing.
With me.
Talk to me about what it made you
apply to be a teacher? Did you apply to be a teacher? What was the process? What made you take a dart and say Zimbabwe and not Malaysia or something?
Chance, pure chance. I was at school, and when I left school, rather, there were various schemes, and I think young people were looking for things to do. I could have gone traveling around the world, or I could have a number of different things. And actually, I saw that came across this scheme where the Ministry of Education was hiring British people. We had to go off and do some training and then come here. So it was pure chance, and one of those things where you don't plan. I didn't plan Zimbabwe. I hadn't thought, oh, I want to go. That's where I want to go. That was the place that came up, and it was pure chance. And the whole of my life has, in some way, been connected to Zimbabwe since. But it was a chance moment.
It's fascinating for me, isn't it, that this chance moment has become so transformational to you, and that's what life is about, isn't it? You're handed chances, you're handing opportunities, and you embrace those opportunities. And they transform you.
I think absolutely right, Trevor. I think you can strategize and you can plan a lot, and it's sometimes good to have a plan, but also it's about taking opportunities. And I think ever since I've taken things that have been interesting or applied for things that have been interesting, and they've been chance moments, and they shape a career and they shape a life. But I've sort of sometimes have a sort of vague plan of where you want to go, but ultimately it's those moments and it's those opportunities. And I think for my kids, they're younger now, as they grow up, you know, making sure people look at those and see what are the opportunities and take them when they get them, or grab them.
Is it a process that you'd recommend to a young person growing up to say, immerse yourself in situations of this nature that then expose what is valuable in life, as you said?
I think putting yourself into difficult positions is a key, for me, it's a key thing to do. So to finding ways to put yourself out of your comfort zone, test yourself in different ways. And I think I've been reading a book at the moment called Do Hard Things, but it's all about how you build mental resilience by putting yourself into difficult circumstances that force you to adjust and to adapt. And I think if anything, for young people today, the thing that they're going to need around the world, wherever you're from, whether you're from the UK or from Zimbabwe, you're going to need those adaptive skills, because that's the world is changing around us at such pace. It isn't going to be linear careers. It isn't going to be linear predictability. So having the ability to find yourself in a new situation, to manage that situation, to adapt to it, I think is going to be one of life's key competences that we're all going to need, and our young people are going to need.
When we started, I said you love this country, because you then came back in 2003 for your honeymoon. I mean, that if anything says this man loves this country, that's that. Talk to me about that decision to say, for my honeymoon, I'm going to Zimbabwe in 2003.
Well, I probably spent about 5 years here on and off, sort of from when I was in Mudzi and Marewa, came back and was in Harare for a bit and in Bulawayo for a bit. So it was in my blood, in a way. I'm a foreigner and I'm British, but in some ways that I'd loved the music, the country, the people I'd met, being so fantastic. And so when I got married, my wife Hannah, she'd obviously heard me talking about Zimbabwe endlessly, and as we'd met and the time we spent.
She's British,
Scottish, mm-hmm. British, yes. And in the time we'd met, she'd heard me, you know, she'd had to put up with me playing Zimbabwean music all the time. She'd had to put up with me talking about Zimbabwe all the time. So when it came to the moment of choosing where should we go on our honeymoon, Zimbabwe was an obvious choice. So there was no question.
Where did you go for your honeymoon?
We came to Harare. We went up to Hippo Pools for a weekend, and across to Vumba, and in the Eastern Highlands.
So you, Pete, you've been back as an ambassador now for a year, and you have, having known the country as not as an ambassador, you've taken time to get to know the country. As a diplomat, as an ambassador, you've talked to a lot of people. Talk to me about what it is that you're hearing from the people that you're talking to, government officials, opposition political parties, and major political parties. What are the concerns that you're encountering regarding this country?
Well, I should first say, I mean, it was never in my wildest dreams that I'd be sitting in this chair talking as a British ambassador, and it's a privilege and an honour that I don't take lightly. I should say it's probably there's probably no, I know this in my heart, there's probably nowhere else in the world where I'll ever be posted where I care so much about the relationship between the two countries, given the history I had here. And you're right, I've spent the last year in a very different context. I should say, just a quick digression, it's really important, I find it really important to try to keep grounded, because suddenly I'm in this position where there's a Union Jack on the front of my car and people call you Your Excellency. And, you know, I think for me, trying to keep remembering what it was like living in Zimbabwe before and keep grounded and keep kind of human is hugely important to me. So, yeah, I spent a lot of time, I spent the last year, I mean, I've been, you know, really, really intentional about building wide sets of relationships across the political spectrum, across the financial and business community, learning as much as I can about the country, not assuming I know things at all. And I think, you know, I'm an optimist, and I'm extremely, as always have been, extremely positive about Zimbabwe, the human capital, the kind of education, the resilience, the natural resources, the climate. There's so much in Zimbabwe to make it such a fantastic country. But of course, I think, you know, there are concerns, and I think, you know, your watchers and your listeners will certainly be aware. And I think, you know, Zimbabweans know better than I do some of the challenges right now, some of the economic challenges, economic stability, for instance, you know, the informalization and jobs, access to power, particularly this time of the year, or this year particularly, in terms of the drought, you know, some really difficult situation for people. So under no illusion of how challenging things are, but continue to be positive about the prospects.
Mm. Well, what are the key issues, I mean, economic and political, that you're coming face to face on a daily basis as you engage with officials, with civil society and political activists?
I think that, you know, one of the key things I've tried to do, and hopefully this comes across in the way that we've been sort of positioning the embassy in recent years, is just first to say, is to try to make sure that we have the relationships where we can have the difficult conversations in private, and we sort of resist the urge or resist the temptation to sort of megaphone diplomacy where we tell Zimbabwe what to do. You know, we need to recognize that as an equal, as a modern partner, we really want this sort of genuine modern partnership between Britain and Zimbabwe. Of equals, where we can discuss things in private. So sort of with that caveat, but I think there are lots of things that you know, Zimbabweans experience every day, the currency stability being a critical issue right now, kind of security of land and land tenure being also very important, sort of the governance structures. And all these sets of issues are kind of wrapped up in a way in terms of the arrears process that the government has started, and we can come to talk about that. So there's a group of issues that sound quite technical,
yeah,
but actually really important for Zimbabwe and Zimbabweans in terms of the sort of the future prospects and making the most of the potential of Zimbabwe.
You know, as a journalist, there's a tendency to want to know before things happen, but there's also a maturity that comes with saying, quiet diplomacy and diplomacy behind the closed doors actually does achieve quite a lot. Are you comfortable? Are you happy that you're making progress with this not telling Zimbabweans what to do? You have a mature relationship. Is that making progress?
Yeah, I often think about it in the context of Ambassador Katsandi, the Zimbabwean ambassador to the UK,
yeah,
and how it would feel if he were telling us the UK what to do on Brexit, for instance, or telling us how to manage our economy. And of course, we wouldn't like that. So vice versa, as a mature relationship, that's important. I always think, what would it be like if Ambassador Katsandi said this, just as a way of framing my own position and how we engage. I think we have made significant effort. I think we've put a lot of the foundations in place in terms of the way our political public diplomacy works, strong foundations. I think you need to back up the foundations with action too.
Yeah, yeah.
It can't just be words. And I know sometimes that's the question is how do we, and I think we have actually, those foundations are firmly in place in terms of the relationship with Zimbabweans across the political spectrum, with government, with political parties, with business, getting firm relationships, building trust. And actually, that, you know, people have confidence in us, in what we're saying, and in our intent. It's always a challenge. Particularly, I think sometimes the legacy of UK involvement and the colonial history.
Yeah.
You know, trying to, you know, we need to demonstrate with actions, not just our words, that we have, you know, positive intent for Zimbabwe, for the relationship between our two countries, for the collective benefit of Britain and Zimbabwe. And I think those foundations are good. There's always going to be more to do in substance on both sides, and we need to keep at it, as all relationships, you need to keep working at them.
Absolutely. I'm going to stop you there, and we're going to take a break at home. Don't go away. When we come back, I know something that you're pretty passionate about, which is the partnership between UK businesses and Zimbabwean businesses. So when we come back, we're going to get to that. Remember, you're watching the UK series brought to you in partnership with the Nyaradza Group. See you on the other side.
But there's a really important process for Zimbabwe about how it restructures its debt.
Yeah.
So there's about $21 billion of debt. $12 billion or so is international debt owed to the international community, to the international financial institutions, the banks, etc.
Welcome back. You're watching the UK series brought to you in partnership with the Nyaradza Group. And I'm in conversation with Peter Vowles, the British ambassador to Zimbabwe. So, Peter, before we left, I did indicate that we were going to look at something that I know you're passionate about, which is the relationship between Zimbabwean businesses and UK businesses. But before we go, there's a big process, one that I would call the elephant in the room, the arrears process. Where are we with that? Are we making progress at all? And who are the partners that are engaged in this conversation?
Thanks, Trevor. So there's a really important process for, I mean, it sounds very gets very technical very quickly, but there's a really important process for Zimbabwe about how it restructures its debt.
Yeah.
So there's about $21 billion of debt, $12 billion or so is international debt, owed to the international community, to the international financial institutions, the banks, etc. And that, because of that amount of debt, I mean, it's a real challenge for the country. Because of that debt, it's very hard, it's impossible for the government of Zimbabwe to borrow money from the international institutions at the moment. So to borrow money from the World Bank or the international. So that's a real constraint on growth, because you don't have access to that cheap finance that other countries do. And it's been, I think, since 1999 that Zimbabwe hasn't had access to that kind of capital. And that would be, in our view, what would unlock growth and the economy, economic growth in Zimbabwe. So we are completely committed as a UK to support that process. There's a set of reforms that the government has set out. This is supported by President Adesina of the African Development Bank and President Chissano doing this with political facilitation. And the government has set out the sort of three sets of things that it wants to make progress on land reform, on economic reforms, and on governance reforms. And so the international community, and particularly in the UK, really keen to make that work because we want to see Zimbabwe grow. And I should just quickly sort of digress slightly in the sense of, if you think about UK interests in Zimbabwe, the sort of overlap of the Venn diagram between Zimbabwean interests and UK interests is growth.
Yeah.
If Zimbabwe can grow in an inclusive manner that, you know, for the whole country, that's brilliant for Zimbabwe. Fantastic. It's also fantastic for the region. That's fantastic for Africa. And from a UK perspective, our self-interest in some ways is that's also good for the UK. It creates new market, creates stability in the world.
Investment opportunities for the British companies.
Actually, the statistic I heard the other day was that a 1% growth in GDP globally would equate to a 1.6% growth in the UK because of the openness of the UK economy. So we have an interest in seeing that growth. Our new government in the UK very keen to make sure that we put growth at the centre of everything we do. And it's got to be good. There's good growth in this pack, but, sure. But actually making sure that growth is inclusive and benefits as many people as possible. And our view is that they're making progress on the arrears, on the debt restructuring would be a game changer for Zimbabwe. It's fair to say that's been a bit stalled in recent months, and we really need to, we're really committed to to regaining momentum on that. And there's a sort of very technical set of working groups, but I think it's really important that we make.
What's caused the process to stall?
I think it's probably a number of things that that obviously put the sort of economic stability, the sort of having a new currency, which is, you know, makes complete sense from a Zimbabwe perspective, has meant that things have been a bit slower to kind of work through the base, the data of it, making progress on land reform. But ultimately, that once that restarts, and we really hope it does restart, that will be the opportunity for us all to move forward together, and for Zimbabwe to make the reforms that it says it wants to make. In order to
which are good for Zimbabwe.
Yeah. I mean, they're driven by Zimbabweans. Yeah. No one has imposed them. They're very much Zimbabwean owned. They align to the national development strategies, and they're very much so. For us, it's saying we would never want to tell Zimbabwe what to do. That's not our job. But where we can get behind locally led plans, that's a fantastic opportunity.
Just clarify to viewers out there, does the UK still have sanctions against Zimbabwe? If you could clarify that point at all.
Yeah, it's a really important question. Mm. There are sanctions against five individuals.
Okay.
It's very hard to kind of win this argument or explain this clearly. What often it gets attributed is that those five sanctions are responsible for the whole economic context in Zimbabwe. And I think, just to be really clear, the fact that five people...
Who are those five people? Would you remember them?
I probably won't go into the details of the five now, but the five individuals five individuals now were sanctioned for a number of reasons, some for on the economic kind of corruption sanctions, some for sort of human rights abuses. And the idea that those five people not being able to travel to the United Kingdom, basically the sanction means you can't travel to the UK, you can't have a bank account in the UK. The idea that those five can't travel to the UK, can't have a bank account, could be responsible for Zimbabwe's economic situation sort of is beyond credible. So it's a complicated one, and I think often it gets played out. We see time and time again, my approach to this in ways, rather than trying to sort of win the argument on that because it's such a powerful storyline, is just to keep demonstrating every day that doesn't get in the way. We've seen a 67% increase in UK-Zimbabwe trade in the past year. We've had three trade missions to Zimbabwe. We've had Zimbabweans investing in the UK. We've just had a brand new investment a couple of months ago in one of the Zimbabwean banks. Mm-hmm. So every time I'm trying to show that actually we can partner together on economic growth, we can trade together, there is nothing in the way. There are five people as part of the UK sanctions policy, but everything else, the remaining 16 million people can operate. And you've just been in the UK yourself.
Absolutely.
Meeting Zimbabweans, making great contributions there. And there's hopefully, I think people would reveal there's British people in Zimbabwe making great contributions. There's nothing to stop us keep doing that, keep deepening that partnership.
Let us go into the partnerships that you are passionate about and which are producing real results. I'm just going to run through them, and I want you to highlight those that are important to you. Is around issue of climate and renewable energy, mining, cooperation between your statistical agents, our statistical agents, and the UK statistical agents. Which of these partnerships to you stand out as examples of the UK and Zimbabwean businesses collaborating with fruitful results?
Yeah, there are so many. I mean, it's worth sort of pausing to say there are so many connections between Britain and Zimbabwe. You just, wherever you look, you find something. Yesterday, I put on social media the 40,000 Cambridge exam papers just arrived for the 154 exam sets.
Yeah.
So there are so many connections wherever you look. But obviously, for us as an embassy, we have to focus on a few key sectors. The things where we think we can make the most impact that will benefit UK firms, but also Zimbabweans, in the renewable sector, that's key. I mean, every Zimbabwean understands the energy challenges better than I do. And accessing renewable constant power is such a great opportunity. So our companies have done quite a lot on, you know, linked into industry, but opportunities to do more. And I've been to see sort of hydropower stations.
Are these mini grids or?
Yeah, so there's a number of different things. There's some solar power mini grids. I'm going next week with the president to commission one in Chipinge, hopefully, which is UK funded. I've been to see hydropower in Hondo Valley, where they're producing power for about a third of Mutare province from using the natural, from the kind of water, from the waterfalls. And then we've got lots of other plans of more solar because we've got the perfect climate, which should be a great opportunity. And Zimbabwe has a range of energy sources, for instance, but we believe that renewable is one thing where we have a real offer. Not only in the UK have government just stopped any new licenses in oil and gas, but actually we see that renewable is a way to get power closer to people. That's the key thing, that actually you don't have to transmit it from across the country. You can have mini grids, renewables go close to people and get power to them. So renewables is a great opportunity. Mining too is an interest. I think we have to be careful here, because what we don't want to fall into the trap of is a sort of new race for critical minerals in a way that is reminiscent of colonial era, when when countries competed over oil, for instance. And actually, what we want is collaboration. I think what we have to offer is that UK firms can bring really high standards. They employ local people, look after local people, environmental standards, social governance standards. That's, for us, is what the UK offer is in the mining sector. And we want to make sure it, as much as possible, is, and I think this fits with government's policy, is that there is local beneficiation. So there is production happening in Zimbabwe that creates jobs for Zimbabweans, and that's for us.
Skills transfer and things of that nature.
Exactly. Yeah. So renewables is mining is important, and then the third real area I think is in agriculture, the horticulture space. I mean, that's where majority of Zimbabweans make a living, and comes from. Such fantastic opportunities. There's also a bit of a sort of helping people prepare for difficult times. So this year, particularly in context of drought, we've been really proud to finance the Mfudza model, really helping getting. I was at a training program the other week in Harare at Foundations for Farming, where they were training agritech workers to go out into communities to show and work with local farmers. These are traditional methods, but how to use
traditional methods, which have become so relevant and so important given the climate changes that we
and how you can grow enough maize and enough. Seeds for oil and enough beans to feed a family for a year on a small plot of land with using minimum amounts of water. So again, that's the kind of thing at one end of the scale is where it's about supporting the kind of the most vulnerable. At the other end, it's how do we encourage and support more trade in agricultural produce. And Zimbabwe has fantastic produce. And we have, when we left the European Union, we transferred duty-free, quota-free tariffs for Zimbabwean products, so Zimbabwean can trade freely with the UK. So you can go, when you're in the UK, I don't know whether you saw any Zimbabwean products in the supermarkets the other week, but increasing, it's not like it was in the 90s, but really trying to capitalize on that. So we've been partnering with the Horticultural Development Council, partnering with various agricultural organizations just to support that and support those trade. And for me, the real strength is when you see communal farmers being brought into the supply chain. So it's not just being a commercial, but a communal farmer being able to grow chilies, getting them into the supply chain and getting them to British supermarkets, which brings jobs, it brings foreign currency, it brings livelihoods. And so I think the agriculture is a real opportunity to do more.
I want to know about the cooperation between the national statistical agencies. Are you in a position to share what kind of collaboration this is?
So in the UK, we have the Office of National Statistics, the ONS, which is our specialist statistics branch, and they are working here with the Zimbabwean Statistics Organization, and that's it's the first time for a long time that we've had a British. It's about skills transfer, so it's not about us giving aid, or it's about a British part of our British government expertise working in partnership with the Zimbabwean institution, part of government, and having someone seconded into the. Zimstats, which I think is a great model for us just being able to work together. And I should say, just going back to agriculture, if I can, Trevor, is...
Sure, absolutely.
I think the, from our new government in the UK, our new foreign secretary, very clear that...
David Lammy,
very clear that that we live in a very complicated world with lots of, big risks to the world. But the most important one, the most fundamental risk is climate emergency. And I think in Zimbabwe, finding ways to think about climate, to think about how we can partner to from agricultural practice through to reforestation, et cetera. So I was in Harungwe last week visiting a project that we funded for the first time, which is working with rural communal farmers to grow trees, indigenous trees. Again, a great example of just, and they're building an incentive model in there that helps, that basically says to farmers, rewards them for planting and looking after trees. So this is a way of, again, that's a whole part of reforestation and something that in that part of the country, given so much timber has been cut for tobacco curing.
Peter, I'm going to stop us here and take a break. When we come back, I want to take us to an interesting space. I've been watching you, and for a year, there's something about your persona that lines up with your work that you do, that brings in a softness to what you do, that brings in a humanness to what you do. And I'm wondering how much of the change in the relationship with Zimbabwe is because of your personality. So when we come back, viewers, don't go away. We're going to go to that interesting place. So see you on the other side.
For a diplomat, I think we had about 1 million people interacting on social media over that weekend. And funnily enough, it's a thing that I get, you know, I can be somewhere in Zimbabwe and get recognized for. Often it's because you hear people saying, Haifa Izzi, Haifa Izzi. And it's because people remember the Haifa Izzi.
You're watching the UK series brought to you in partnership with the Nyaradza Group. I'm in conversation with Peter Vowles, the British ambassador to Zimbabwe. One thing that you've done that absolutely fascinated me was Haifa reeds. I mean, for me, that was beauty in digital diplomacy, soft power. Talk to me about the inspiration, the thinking process behind Haifa reeds, because it just took social media by storm. It showed that you can achieve so much by doing small things that matter, but much more importantly, by positioning yourself in the public eye as somebody who is fully immersed in the society that you're working in. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, thank you, Trevor. It's interesting. It was an interesting, fantastic few days. First, I think it's worth just saying that one of the great things about being an ambassador, I think, is that our policy is set by our ministers in the UK, but the how you do it is completely up to you. And that's a fantastic freedom to think, how do I want to do this job? How am I going to position myself? Yes, I've got clear policy goals, clear instructions from London, but I have freedom to decide how. And I've tried, and I think, you know, not just me, my predecessor similarly, tried to bring a human side to being an ambassador, to be kind of, you know, we're all normal people, we're all human, we all have the same wants and needs as anybody else, and we're not in this ivory tower. So I've tried particularly, and I think probably helped by the context that I've arrived and understood a bit about Zimbabwe from before. But Haifa Izzi, which is this cooking challenge, I mean, it was, again, back to the beginning, it was a complete chance moment.
Wow.
So you'll know of Joe Hussein, the Team Fulu guy, the engineer living in London. And he literally just said, oh, what, you know, maybe we should have an ambassador challenge on social media. And I just instantly responded, yes, why not? I didn't talk to the comms team, didn't talk to anyone else. I said, yeah, well, that sounds a great idea. Why not? And then over the course of the week, met other diplomatic colleagues, and we sort of said, oh, come on, let's just do this and encourage others to do it. And then we agreed to cook Haifa Izzi. And as the week proceeded, just thought more, you know, without necessarily having a plan or a strategy.
Pivoting, iterating.
Okay, what should we do? Okay, yeah. Let's do this outside. Let's go, rather than doing it in a kitchen. So we went and built a fire in my garden and put it on a pot and started. I thought, why don't I go and practice my shona and go down to the market and buy my vegetables? So I went down to the market, bought myself a 2-liter thing of chibuku, did a little mini video. So it was all unplanned, thinking, well, how can we make this fun? How can we make this interactive? And you're right. I mean, we were completely blown away by the response. I think we thought, nothing like your audience rates, but for a diplomat, I think we had about 1 million people interacting on social media over that weekend. And funnily enough, it's a thing that I get, you know, I can be somewhere in Zimbabwe and get recognized for often. It's because I hear people say, hi, Farizi. And it's because people remember the hi, Farizi. So it had a sort of slightly viral flavor to it. But it was good.
What did he tell you about your job? And what was the most surprising response to hi, Farizi?
I think it told me that my job is, I have a formal protocol side of my job that is going to formal events and having the car with a flag and, you know, being the ambassador. But I also have a human role, and that's about connecting with people and connecting with different audiences. And I, you know, something we try really hard in the embassy is, how do we connect to new audiences? How do we break out so that we're, you know, and for me, a great success when we hold events at the residence is, if you haven't been here before, then we're succeeding in a way. We're getting new people and talking to new people, learning new things. And connecting via food turns out to be quite a good way to connect with people. So it was just a fantastic, and I think, you know, fantastic by being human, by being normal, is just a great way to connect.
Which takes me to the question that I asked before we took a break. That, you know, I wonder sometimes, how much is your personality driving policy rather than policy driving what you do? Because you've come in and have changed this office and have changed the way even the government interacts with you. You have humanized this job. Attending your functions is such a lovely thing because you've lots of humor and so forth. You are not too self-righteous or too important for your job. Talk to me about that.
Well, it's very kind of you. Very flattering to hear you say that. I think it's, I mean, hopefully it's not purely personal. It's not purely me. This is a British government policy, and I am part of an instrument of British government policy, which is about wanting a different kind of partnership in Africa and a different kind of partnership in Zimbabwe. We've got a really tough history here, through colonial history, through the 2000s and land reform, through to today. And we want to have it. We want to change that. We want to be a more modern, more equal partner, as we talked about earlier. So I am, you know, my approach as part is doing that, and that's what ministers in the UK want us to do. And then obviously there's the how, which is sort of style I've tried to bring to it. And I think it is. I think you framed it really well, Trevor. It's about trying to not be above this. Not to. You can slip in this job anywhere in the world. You can slip into the protocol and the formality.
The importance.
You can get used to people calling you Your Excellency. And you know, when you go back home, you're a normal person with the same troubles as everybody else, managing your family like anybody else, just getting through life. And suddenly you can be in this sort of transported to this kind of context. So I think it's about, for me, and I think for many others, it's about trying to keep connected to being, keep grounded, feet on the ground, being the human being that we are, trying to, you know, I think you have to exaggerate a bit the humility to try and make sure that people feel comfortable with you.
That opens doors, doesn't it?
I think it opens doors.
It oils relationships.
I think so. And I think being, you know, people, there'll be probably quite a bit of distrust about a British ambassador in Zimbabwe. Does he really mean it? Is he? And sometimes I see on social media the kind of conspiracy theories. And that's fine. My job is to convince people slowly, bit by bit, person by person, that actually we do mean it and we do have good intent. And I think the way to do that is, yes, there's kind of formal bilateral meetings, but partly how we position the embassy and myself and my colleagues. You know, it's not just a, you know, I work for an organization with a number of people, and it's not just about Pete. It's about, I end up being the front of it, but all of us across the embassy, the way we interact, the way we're building new relationships.
Pete, we've spoken about your love for this country. We've spoken about the personality that you are, but I think it's important to realize that you are a leader in your own right. You have extensive experience. And I want to find out from you, you've been the director in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. You've been chargé d'affaires in Yangon. You have been in Asia. You have been in Nairobi. Of all these jobs, which ones for you have formed you as a diplomat, as a civil servant? Which ones have really done the biggest heavy lifting in who you've become?
Goodness. Difficult question, isn't it? Everything makes a contribution. Your life, we all move through life, and every interaction kind of makes you who you are today and will continue to make you who you are. Obviously, my time in Zimbabwe has clearly been really important in this context. Funny enough, I worked for the UK National Health Service, so not a diplomat. I was a hospital
NHS.
NHS. I was a hospital manager in the NHS, and that was another sort of transformational part of my career.
In what way?
Because as a young hospital manager, and the NHS runs a fantastic training program for managers, where you spend your time doing everything in the system. So you see the system from all sorts of different perspectives. And I think that's, that actually, working in the NHS, I spent time with the doctors, time with the porters, time in the canteen, time in procurement, time with the ambulances. And you see this really complex system operate. And I think that's really important for diplomacy, because actually we work in a really complicated ecosystem of interests of within Zimbabwe and internationally. And being able to, not saying I can do this perfectly, but being able to see different perspectives is absolutely fundamental to diplomacy, to be able to understand where someone's coming from, to see what they're, to get to the bottom of what their interest is, because ultimately diplomacy is about finding that common ground. What is it that we collectively want to achieve together? Building the relationships, building trust, building confidence. So I kind of attribute a lot back to a time in a very different field, but similarly quite important. And obviously through my career, I've worked in Africa and worked in Asia in a number of different countries, and being able to kind of practice and hone those skills. And whatever I do next will continue to develop.
So Zimbabwe has been transformational in who you've become. What do you take away to, let's say, to your posting to Washington, to a posting in Germany, from what Zimbabwe has done informing you? What do you take?
I think it depends on what happens next in career. I've sort of got plenty of time left here in Zimbabwe, I hope so. Lots to do here still. But I think it is those perspectives. I think you fit in this role, I feel it. I feel the colonial history more firmly than I've ever felt before.
Really?
And I'm very conscious of it, and I'm learning about it. And I think that actually how that shapes how Zimbabweans view the UK, for good and for bad, is very specific to this relationship. But I think actually, given the Britain's role in the world and history, wherever I might end up...
But you can't erase that.
Exactly. And wherever I may end up in the future... The understanding that perspective of where, what the role Britain played in the past, what we might want to do in the future, but actually understanding that is a really key. I don't want to linger on the past, I want to look forward.
Yeah.
But it's important to understand it. And I think Zimbabwe's taught me that in this job in a way that perhaps I haven't had before.
What will you want? I mean, you've done 1 year. I'm sorry to ask you this question, but as you walk away after your term is done, what do you want us to remember you for?
Well, hopefully, Trevor, we'll get to meet a few more times before then. I've got many years left, I hope.
Yeah.
I think, it is genuinely about having, I will want to look back that myself and my team, it's not all about me.
Of course.
We have built on the foundation, built a genuinely different kind of partnership between Britain and Zimbabwe, one that is modern, one that was of equals, one where we respect each other's sovereignty, but we are able to progress together with across the country, not just government to government, but Zimbabweans, our institutions, our people links, our business links. And there's going to be, there has to be sort of substance behind each of those phrases. But I would like people to say, actually, the British Zimbabwean relationship is at a new level. And we can now, we're no longer talking about the past of the relationship. We're looking forward together to what we can do together.
I love the UK. I love London. I love, shopping around Oxford Street. What's been your favorite tourist destination in Zimbabwe? What's the place that you go to unwind in Zimbabwe?
Well, I've traveled a lot actually in Zimbabwe. I think in my first 4 months, I calculated that I traveled 6,000 kilometers in Zim. I think I've lost count now. I've been to every province. I think I said to the office when I first got here, I want to make sure I've been to every province in the first year. I think I smashed
you
that.
You did that, yeah.
Now I'm thinking about every district. So I think I've worked out on the car the other day. I think I've been to 25 districts in Zimbabwe. So I've still got another 35 or so to go. I mean, there was obviously the kind of fantastic tourism opportunities of Zimbabwe. And, I was hiking in the Eastern Highlands the other week, and, it's absolutely marvelous. There's a love of the Matopus and Matabele land. I still get a shiver when I go to Marewa or Motoko, because that's where I started. So I spend my weekends often. I'm training for this ridiculous race, running race in December. So I spend my weekends often in
Vic Falls.
I'm training for the Sky Run, which is a 56-kilometer race through the Eastern Highlands. I don't know why I signed up to it, but anyway.
I was going to ask you why. But
that means I spend my weekends looking for copies, looking for mountains to run and practice. So I go out to Goma Carrera and out to Marewa because they're kind of close to where I live, relatively. And I just love I love it there. So that's my go-to place on a weekly basis. But having the opportunity to explore the country, and I try and profile it a bit because I think there's such incredible tourism for others as well.
Apart from Sadza, what's your favorite food, Zimbabwean food?
I've been known to eat Sadza quite a fair amount. I choose to eat Sadza. I mean, obviously, Haifa-Rizzi was a thing. Wherever I am, I like Sadza and Mbonzo.
Oh, yes.
I like, you know, Mazondo. And I've learned to like, I guess. Last week I was traveling in Harungwe and we had that fantastic Mariwa and Ndovi.
Beautiful.
Lots of great Zimbabwean food.
Pete, wonderful talking to you. Like I said, we're part of the UK series. And I'm going to be twisting your arm next year so that you and I go together to do the UK series in partnership with the Nyaradza Group. And we do fantastic conversations. So I'm going to be working on you.
I'd love to.
Come along. Discuss books now, and our viewers out there love books. We've created a WhatsApp group, by the way, which is subgroups and amazing conversations. Join us. We will have a link below this video that will take you to give you the details for that amazing WhatsApp group for the Trevor Book Club. So we tend to books. I thought I'd use this opportunity to push a couple of books to your fellow diplomats. And I love the fact that you're saying the notion of colonialism just has come even bigger and alive whilst you are doing this job. This book...
It's a great book.
...is a heartbreaking book. It's a painful book, which I really recommend that every Western diplomat who is posted to Africa reads this book and understand the burden that colonialism has impacted on the African continent.
Yeah.
King Leopold's Ghost, A Story of Greed, Terror, and Heroism in Colonial Africa. This is something else.
I was fortunate enough to serve in DRC. I spent 4 years in Kinshasa, and so that, I mean, it's heartbreaking.
It explains why, in a big way, the DRC is what it is today. Interrupted development. So please, all my good friends who are in Zimbabwe, you've been posted to Zimbabwe, a Western diplomat, please read this book. It will make you understand Africa in a better way. The other book, Pete, that I'm recommending is this one.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Oh, this is a must read. This is again to my diplomatic friends from the West. You must understand Africa, and this book is hugely important for that. It's called Born in Blackness: Africa and Africans and the Making of the Modern World, 1471 to the Second World War, by my good friend Howard W. French. It's a very important book for you to understand the pain that the West has caused on Africa. Not that becomes our crutch that colonialism did this and this to us, because we've had many years of freedom for us to correct what colonialism did to Africa. Let me turn to you now. What books, three books, do you recommend to our book lab audience?
Well, I've got two kind of on a similar theme, actually, that I've read recently. One is Satnam Sangera's book, Empire Land. I don't know whether you've come across
that. No, I haven't read that.
And it's a fantastic, for someone, for a British, it's about the impact of empire on the UK and things that we never learned at school. I mean, actually, shamefully, I think we probably didn't. I didn't learn much about colonialism at school. Didn't learn about roads, didn't learn about Rhodesia.
Fascinating, isn't it?
And it is fascinating that, you know, now that we didn't learn that at school. So to read Empire Land to understand some of the themes of the impact of everyday, the impact on British economy, of
society,
of what happened during of colonialism and the impact of empire on Britain. So that's a great, you know, as someone working in a former British colony, to read that and just make those connections. The other book I've really enjoyed similarly is Dipo Falian's Africa is Not a Country. Again, a similar sort of theme. These are where it covers all sorts of issues that are just so relevant here in Zimbabwe. So the sort of artifacts and human remains and these sort of things, are horrific things that happened during colonial era, that the sort of white savior complex and sort of how Africa is portrayed and the idea there's a sort of single story and there isn't, you know, there's a much more diverse story. So it's a great sort of, again, for some of the diplomats, so I recommend diplomats who haven't read those two books. Coming to Zimbabwe anywhere in Africa to read those two.
The third book?
I'm going to have to choose two. I'll tell you why. Because the first one that I'm still reading, and it's a quite heavy read, but I'm loving it, is Banning Ayer's Lion Songs, which is a story of Thomas Mapfumo's life and career. And it starts in Chimurenga music and worked through in colonial times and works through to independence in 1980 and Bob Marley being here and through the 90s and all the, you know, Leonard Dembos and Jakartas and all the Zimbabwean musicians. That's just a great. It's not only about music, and it reminds me of my. You know, I think I said at the beginning, I've sort of made my children listen to
Thomas
Mapfumo and Oliver Mtukudzi. And I was lucky enough to be at the inaugural Oliver Mtukudzi Festival of the Arts on Saturday last week. But yeah, they had to listen. It's been a soundtrack to their lives. So the book is great because it just tells a story, and it's nice actually to go back and the sort of role of Chimurenga, the role of Mbira music in liberation era all the way through to today. The reason I've given you three male authors and I can't give three men. So the other book I've just finished reading is Valerie Taguira's The Uncertainty of Hope, which is a quite a heartbreaking story of female trade. It's a novel. But a great novel about female traders living in Mbari and just the sort of daily trials and tribulations of living in Mbari. So again, something just, you know, for me, just keeping connected to people's realities has been a good one to read.
Fantastic, Pete. You have to me given a very interesting angle of what the life of a diplomat is and how you can change relations between two countries by the way you carry yourself. You've done that. I've attended cocktails to celebrate the king's birthday, and I felt that, and I've seen that, and I can see it in the relationship of the two countries. So the relationship between Zimbabwe and the UK is an important one. That sets the tone for our relationship with other nations. So I'm excited that we've got you to be instrumental in crafting that relationship. So thank you so much for finding the time to sit here and have this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It's
been that tender.
Siabong.
Siabong. Allow me to tender Pete and address our viewers who are all over the world to say thank you so much for making us the success that we are. Let me just remind you, we're currently sitting on 9.4 million views. We are on 64,000 subscribers. We are massive on TikTok and on Instagram. To ensure that you don't miss out in any of these quality conversations, such as one I've just had now with Pete, remember please to subscribe, to like, and to share. Go below this video and share your comments on the conversation that we've just had right now. We love to hear what you think, the good and the bad. Until next time, cheers to you all.